in the multiverse of work. We're not in the future of work. We're in a whole different timeline. We would have never had this same trajectory if we hadn't had the pandemic. Making sure you're delivering on the promise of AI, which is we were going to take away the mundane and boring task and then fill your day up with all of this creative, exciting work, because that's what AI is supposed to do. When you just take away someone's actual job and then not replace it with creative opportunities, it can be a very subconscious feeling. But if you're uncertain about what your future looks like and no one's telling you that you're safe or that you're going to even be skilled up to be part of the organization, whether AI or not is going to take over a certain aspect of your role, all of these things make people tune out.
Welcome to Artificial Insights, the podcast where we learn to build AI people need and use by interviewing product leaders who have launched AI products. I'm your host, Daniel Mineri, and today we're joined by someone who has been at the forefront of understanding workplace culture and how it's evolving in this new era. Jennifer Moss is an award-winning journalist, Harvard Business Review columnist, and a globally recognized expert on workplace well-being and leadership. She's here today because of her recent book, Why Are We Here?, and has written previously The Burnout Epidemic and Unlocking Happiness at Work. Her research has shaped how leaders think about engagement, mental health, and the future of work. Her latest book, Why Are We Here?, comes at a critical moment as AI transforms the workplace, raising big questions about leadership, purpose, and what it really means to create a work culture people want to be a part of. Jennifer, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not specifically building AI, which I think is important for everyone that's listening to know that about me. I've worked in tech in that I was a co-founder of a tech company for many years, and it was really interesting because this was way back in the day before well-being and wellness was something that anyone wasn't laughing at, because that's pretty much where we were when you talk about AI and how people thought about it. Again, in those early days, it was this idea of a dystopian future, and here we are. But I was working with my co-founder, and we were bringing, the hope was, predictive analytics around people that were stressed or well, and how that ended up leading to business outcomes. So obviously our hypothesis and the data and research agrees that the more healthy and well you are, the better you perform, right? So we thought, okay, what if we could have insights that came in for people so that they could then, you know that they were feeling stressed. And so we could help them develop, you know, higher well-being. And then we could start to track that for CEOs to show, okay, when you actually care about your employees, here's the ROI. So that was our big hairy goal. And we moved from a startup to a stay-up, which was pretty cool. And the technology was great. And then the pandemic hit and it was just too hard to stay alive, and everything had changed. I was doing a lot of public speaking, and that obviously completely changed because I was no longer in public. But a lot of my background really is workplace culture and strategy within organizations, but also how do we make work feel more like fuel instead of like a grind? And that, I think, has been my mission statement. And so from the AI standpoint, the reason why that I think even maybe you and I are chatting today is that we're seeing this massive increase in FOBO, that fear of becoming obsolete, and AI anxiety, especially in our younger cohorts at work who are worried that AI is going to take over their jobs, which in many cases we're seeing that shift, but helping organizations and leaders do a better job of adopting AI and then also making sure that their team feels a sense of readiness for the future with AI as a partner.
Very cool. Recently, you've written a book. It's called Why Are We Here? Could you just tell us briefly what the book is about?
Yeah, it's an existential question for an existential time. And I think for me, I was writing The Burnout Epidemic pre-pandemic. And in the pandemic, it was obviously a news peg. It just completely exploded. Burnout became ubiquitous. Everyone knows what that is now. And I was in this stage of launching the book. I was traveling all the time and I kept hearing these conversations, and often with Uber drivers. I think I interviewed in the end over 100 Uber or Lyft drivers through the course of the writing of the book, along with other employees, executives, and academics and experts. But what I kept hearing were these people that had made these massive leaps in their roles, from Wall Street now driving Uber to women leaving the workforce, deciding to work in delivery or rideshare so that they could have more flexibility because they were burned out. We saw, there was a story that I include right at the beginning of the book of Kara, who was on track to be the first female Black partner, lost three people in the pandemic and decided to drive an Uber. And I would ask people why they make these huge career pivots at a lot of financial shift and stress in many cases. And everyone just said, life is short. And they were sitting, doing what they were doing, like they do every day, and were asking themselves, what is the point? Why am I here? And that led me on the path of discovery for this book.
Mm. And what is it that really excites you about that topic personally?
Well, I found the research on mortality salience super fascinating. Jeffrey Greenberg started talking about what happens when we face the finitude of our lives. And he talks about it as an extreme stress event for people. And what he saw in the last 5 years was so shocking. And he was writing and doing so much more research about it. He says that when we do face that anxiety of our lives coming to a potential end or at risk of ending, we become very self-confirming. We attach to other people that confirm our biases. It creates polarization. We actually are, and this is not all of us, this is a group. And that anxiety makes us feel like we need to hold on to our core values more than ever. So we'll stand up for those core fundamental beliefs. And this is a big part of why he saw this increase in kind of cultism and followership and the stuff that was going on politically. But then on the other hand, which you saw in even greater numbers, is this increase in pro-sociality. So if you're a pro-social kind of altruistic person before you face your finitude of your life, that amplifies. So all the people that were good people became better, you know, and more giving and caring, and also wanted to have a bigger impact on the world. They wanted to be purposeful and meaningful. And what they were doing, and this is why the Great Resignation so interestingly happened, is that a lot of people said, life is short. I want to do something really special. And I don't want to be in this job. And this job feels like a toxic grind. And this is not how I can spend the very few days, because this is very subconscious, the few days that I have left here, you know, it could go anytime. I better be making the most of it. And so I believe that a lot of the economic shift, the workforce change, has happened with this sense of mortality salience. And for me, I think that's just super fascinating.
I'm very interested in spending our time well. I feel like I came to my own mortality salience moment when I was a young teenager, and I've had to revisit that several times. And each time I find deeper purpose in what I do and shift my career even. So yeah, I love that.
I love that because some people call it post-traumatic growth. And I think from a psychological sciences standpoint and behavioral sciences standpoint, we are going through these growth moments for some, and then there is a regression for others. And I think that's why we're seeing such a split. But what is also really compelling is that the pandemic wasn't just a crisis that forced us to face the finitude of our lives. We're in polycrisis, and climate anxiety and some of these other things are making that ever present. So it's, again, it's, this is why we as leaders and in organizations have to recognize that this isn't just like a put it in the rear view pandemic thing. This is we're going to have people persistently querying, why am I here? Because they are going to feel a sense of life is short until we solve for these big problems or increase sense of hopefulness. Then that's going to be the state of play, I think, for workers across the world.
Just to shift gears a little bit, there's a question that I think is on everyone's mind for a podcast like this, which is, Jennifer, are you an AI?
Am I an AI? Am I an AI? That's a good question. How should I answer like ChatGPT would?
Good
processing the user query. No, I am not AI.
I actually wanted to mention too that reading your book, I've come to, I think, a pretty keen sense of when people write with AI, and I'm fairly certain that you don't, and I really appreciated that.
I don't. I'm maybe old school about that stuff. However, this is where I think AI is so cool, because I partnered with AI. Because when I was in writing The Burnout Epidemic, I'm really big on evidence-backed writing. It's so important for me to spread information that is factually accurate. And so I like to go to big sample sizes. I go to academic research that's been peer-reviewed. It isn't just like a survey of 1,000 people. It's really digging in. And so for The Burnout Epidemic, I'm reading thousands of papers and journal articles, which are intense. It was just so tiring and leading me to burnout, which was ironic. But with Why Are We Here, I could say, I'm investigating this thought or this idea that I have. What kind of research papers are out there that you could provide me with so I could have a read through? And if there was a lot of jargon, it was great to be able to say, can you distill this in a way that feels like, okay, it's worth me reading further? Because if I spend all the time, sometimes these papers are 50 pages and I get to the end and find the conclusion is just like not matching at all what I want to be pointing to. This gives me that ability to shorten that process. And so it was really hugely beneficial for me to have those kinds of benefits. Plus, I had AI as a transcriber for this one too. For all of my interviews, I used Scribe and others in meetings. And so that alone probably saved me 100 hours.
Very cool. And I want to encourage everyone listening to not let AI read the book for you either, because I think there's a tendency to summarize everything down to almost uselessness, but you'll get a lot more out of the book if you read it with your own eyes.
I love that you said that, because it really, there's a lot of richness to the data. And I talk about the return to office mandates, and I talked with Mark Ma and his team, and I read through the research data, and I spend a lot of time. And then when it's distilled, really, you only get this very condensed viewpoint of it, even in the book, because it has to be edited down so that it's people want to read it and they're not totally bored to tears with my detail and technical analysis of research. So then, yes, yeah, so sometimes when it gets distilled even further, you do lose that kind of the meatiness of it.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to distill Romeo and Juliet. So there's certainly writing you should use your own mind for.
Okay. I really love you for saying that. You just gave a comparison to Shakespeare, and I feel like that's maybe the coolest thing I've ever heard. So I don't own that, but I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer. I have a huge ream of questions here, so we won't go through all of them, but there are a couple of things that really stood out to me. And one of the first ones was actually a very human moment as well, where you quote from Cloud Cuckoo Land at the very beginning of the book. And it was one of those things where I looked at it and I said, I wonder why she quoted that. And it would never have shown up in a summary, obviously. And so I did a little reading, and that sense of shared narrative over time is what I interpreted that as. But yeah, what drove you to include that quote?
I think that's it. You nailed it. It's the stories that we tell that give context to life and to all of the other things that feel inexplicable and also overwhelming. And I think that's what Anthony Doerr does such a good job of. I'm a huge fan of his and that book. It's on my top five. But it's about being able to also touch different points in history through a narrative and understanding what we've done in the past so that we can make change that's relevant for the future. And this whole idea of repeated history, we're just seeing it right now in such a big way that it's on us to learn and make a positive impact. And so I think that's what it really is about, is how are we going to share this story? How are we going to tell this point in time? And how is that going to impact the future? Because I feel like there's a precipice. And I've been saying we're in the multiverse of work. We're not in the future of work. We're in a whole different timeline. We would have never had this same trajectory if we hadn't had the pandemic. We just wouldn't have had so many people working from home. We wouldn't have all collectively faced our mortality at the exact same time and had such loss and such shared grief. And that this timeline that we're on, that makes it even more important to share stories of the other timeline and prepare for what this is going to look like, which is a future no one really has any framework for.
Yeah. I like to say that all linear predictions of the future are wrong, including this one. I feel like nobody knows what AI is going to do. But in your interviews and the people research, what have you heard that AI contributes to this moment in time?
Gosh, it's having a major impact. There is this data point that I thought was really interesting, and CEOs and their top disruptors, technology was not even the top six of their most biggest disruptors that they were worrying about in 2019. And that number went from, in 2020, it moved to maybe out of the six main disruptors, it was on the list finally. And it, within 2 years, it shot up to number one. And now AI and technology and this rapid escalation of adoption is really freaking out everyone, because there's this pressure for senior leaders and CEOs to adopt AI. Like, we got to just, there's this mentality like, we can't get behind. It's going to make us, you know, not competitive. It's going to impact our ability to be future ready if we don't have AI. But then there's also this other side where I don't even know why I'm doing this. What, like, why am I doing this? I don't really have a strategy. I don't really have a plan. I don't really have a communication strategy that I'm prepared to enact. My employees are feeling like there's no plan. They feel obsolete. And the senior executives, senior leaders are feeling this push and pull, this battle of having to adopt something that they don't even know why they're adopting. And so I think that there needs to be a pause. And something happened in the pandemic that created this toxic productivity, this sense of false urgency. And this false urgency has now made people, and I think at the executive level, feel like they have to be moving at such a fast pace to be able to make sure that stakeholders and shareholders are happy. And yet what's come at the cost of that is not having sustainability. And I think that what AI is doing is amazing in a lot of ways, but we're not really appreciating the promise of AI because it's scattered in the way that we've assimilated into the workforce. It's ubiquitous in so many areas of our lives, and a lot of people don't even understand how much it is just assimilated in our lives. When in the book I asked, there's this really great survey that really asks people how much they use AI, and 50% of people say never. And when you start to ask them, do you use this? Do you use this? Do you use this? And then all of a sudden it's actually 95% of AI that they're using in their lives. And so I think that component has been interesting, but if leaders did a better job at work, they wouldn't have so many people fearing this kind of this doomsday scenario. So I do think it's playing a big role in a lot of ways, but I think we've missed the point on how to ensure that AI is delivering on its promise.
Now, there's a couple of topics in there that are, I think, really big and important, but you touched on earlier, I don't know that I've ever heard anyone say it before. So when you said it, I said, ah, that's what it is. It's that, that's the name for it, that fear of becoming obsolete. And what does that mean? And how is that happening in the workforce?
Gallup data and this Microsoft Trends report that they partnered with LinkedIn to really uncover how people are feeling. And 1 in 2 workers globally are expressing a sense of AI anxiety. And they had a very robust data set. And what I think is most interesting that Gallup found is that it is in our younger cohort more than it has been before, because obsolescence used to really be around automation and being forced out through the new robots that were coming into warehouses, and sectors weren't feeling as fear of obsolescence as maybe others like manufacturing, but now it's pervasive. And that has a lot to do with AI. And what happens when you feel a sense of obsolescence, it reduces your hopefulness. So you don't see yourself in the future of that organization. It makes you less loyal because you don't feel like you're necessarily being cared for. And it can be a very subconscious feeling. But if you're uncertain about what your future looks like and no one's telling you that you're safe or that you're going to even be skilled up to be part of the organization, whether AI or not is going to take over a certain aspect of your role, all of these things make people tune out. They disengage, which is why we're seeing the highest level of active disengagement that we've seen in 10 years. And all of these new policies that people are trying to bring back in to impact engagement and to improve productivity, the thing is that we need to get to the root behavioral barriers, which is, I'm scared. I don't know what is happening. I'm uncertain. And you haven't done a good job of communicating to me. And so I think that obsolescence can be rectified. All of these big, huge business challenges that I think everyone's freaking out about, they're actually very solvable. And the thing is, it's going back to the familiar. It's novel because it's a different approach potentially, and it's dealing with a new problem. But at the same time, the way that we take care of these issues inside of our organization is through humanity, asking people what they're stressed out about, finding out people's skill level, making sure you're delivering on the promise of AI, which is we were going to take away the mundane and boring task and then fill your day up with all of this creative, exciting work, because that's what AI is supposed to do. When you just take away someone's actual job and then not replace it with creative opportunities, it should be that person that was data mining is now providing data insights. They're looking at it with a different lens and be able to communicate the benefits of what they've learned. We have to skill people up to do that. And that hasn't happened. And so I think these are all very solvable things. Making sure that we don't have ageism at work with this idea of reverse mentorship, making sure it's about peer mentorship. Google does that really well, where people that are cool and smart at stuff, they just host classes randomly and people can go and learn from different people. You can be 55, you can be 25, it doesn't matter. It's all about just learning cool stuff from other people. It's all about learning. It's all about curiosity, exploration. And the more that becomes part of the culture, which is not hard to do, it just amplifies our excitement and our enthusiasm for AI.
Yeah. I speak to people all the time who ask me questions like, do I need to get a PhD? Or especially if they are younger, they're wondering what happens to the entry-level jobs. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be disappearing a little bit in some cases. Mm-hmm. But is there anything in particular that you would say to someone who is fearing becoming obsolete to help them deal with that?
It's really terrifying for a lot of young people that are hearing 300 million jobs or, you know, whatever. Everyone's going to be replaced by AI. I mean, you know, that can feel terrifying. What's the point? And I have to put a caveat there. AI is not going to replace everyone's job because that's an economic catastrophe. What? Are you going to have everyone not working? Then you can have no one buying anything. That's just not how capitalism works. So yeah, if everyone just had their jobs replaced, we'd be in serious trouble. Government would have to take care of billions of people on their dime that aren't working. So let's not worry about that. If that comes to play, I'm sure there'll be a lot of mandates that will ensure that large organizations are keeping humans hired. So I think that it's just looking at the long goal of what are the things that you really love to do and what do you care passionately about, and understand that there's a role that you can play in using AI to partner in that space. I think what we've learned with this life is short mentality is that if you are miserable, no matter what you do, you're just not going to be great at your job. It just doesn't seem to be the thing that motivates us. It becomes passionless. And we're seeing our younger generation just completely leave the standard route of career pathing that Xers and boomers have followed. They're figuring out how to have four jobs maybe that all bundle together to make a good enough life that also includes work-life balance. And work-life balance and well-being are not antithetical to work ethic. It's about pulling those things together to understand that this is about a life well-lived and work being fuel for that. So I think it has to be A, that you feel connected to what you're doing. And then B, it's like, how do I make sure that technology can be married with what I'm doing? And then I know how to optimize technology for that thing that I care about. And it amplifies then what you're doing. But I think worrying about obsolescence is just holding us back from actually living a life that work is fuel versus where work is a grind.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. It's bringing it back to, I think you have a stat in your book of something like 70% of people find their meaning through work. And that's intimidating. But I like you've framed it as a form of hope, which is to find your meaning in a way that doesn't necessarily rely on that traditional definition of work.
It's really about life satisfaction. And we get we got tunnel vision because we spend 50% of our waking hours at work. It makes sense. Or 90. Now I think it's around 110,000 hours at work in a lifetime. So you want it to be an enjoyable part of your life. Like, how can you have life satisfaction and even longevity if you spend so many of your hours stressed out and unwell? So we need to start looking at the bigger picture of work being in our lives in partnership with our lives. And it just doesn't need to be this balance. So one is equally balanced against the other. There's lots of times where I say it's like triage, whatever's bleeding, whatever's bleeding the most in the moment. Sometimes I just have to take care of that thing. The idea of work being in partnership means that it's beyond work. It's like having that all integrated into our lives in a very meaningful way. It doesn't also mean that your purpose can't be pay or a paycheck. Do you know how many Uber drivers I spoke to who were working in this role so that they could put their kids into a good school? It was just, that was a lot of part of caring about them, making sure that they could have a home and a life that was in a good environment for their children. And that's great. That's purpose right there. So it can be anything that is part of what motivates you, and pay can be that. And you don't have to love every part of your job or every day has to be magical. It's just, how are you looking at the tasks that you do every single day and associate that with something that connects to who you are and your values and what matters to you in your life? And if you can make those connections, that's how you find the value and the purpose. It's not going to be a mission statement. It's going to be how you can live that out every day.
And I think that advice holds true regardless of whether you're starting your career or ending it.
Absolutely. And I actually think that what this younger cohort is doing is, A, doing what every other generation does, pushing back on the status quo. That's their job. That's what they're supposed to do. Why are we so shocked? And then B, they're telling us that the model we've given them for work is terrible and they don't want, like, we're terrible models. So why would they want to follow in our footsteps? They want to look at this as, okay, what can be different in the way that I lead my life? And they've come in to a moment of huge cataclysmic disruption. So no wonder they're going to also have that amplified. So I think this idea that it's like we label this generation, there's a huge rise in youngism, which I find so unfortunate. And that rise in youngism is just, they're coming into a workforce where people are already thinking that they're lazy and entitled. And that's really unfair because this is the generation that is going to develop the workforce of the future. And we're sort of opting them out already.
I think one of the things I liked about your book was that you spend a lot of time on, I would call it holding the executives accountable to say work could be different, it should be different. And one of the things I like to encourage, I've had a lot of co-ops at work report to me before, and I always like to encourage them that you should hold your bosses accountable. It's not just something that they get to do whatever they want. What do you feel like someone who is entering the workforce for the first time should expect?
You know, I think that it's really important to understand that work is still boring and tedious sometimes. Like, and that is how it is. I love my job, and there's days where I think, oh my gosh, especially writing a book there can be points where you really do feel like it's a grind. It can feel tiring and exhausting. And so I think it's important to have a reality check that it is hard and it is challenging. And having that ability to set that reality is critical. But a lot of it is, there's a lot of, in those early days where you have to recognize first year university, where you're taking all of these courses that you don't need. And by the time you get into fourth year, it's specialized. That's like your career. Your first few years are really just getting acclimated and learning how to manage up and learning about conflict resolution and learning how to just deal with going into work every day. And that can be boring and tedious. And then after that, you start to move into places with more autonomy. And then you get to craft your career a little bit more. And as you move inside of an organization, or even as you move around in your career, that there is this ability to have growth. So there's stuff in our control. And then there are things that are not in our control, you know, bad policies, a bad boss, and a lot of things that we can't control even inside of an organization, like a pandemic and political disruption and big, huge things that are happening. So I think what is really critical is say, okay, what is in my control? What isn't in my control? How am I going to make it work for me inside of the kind of confines of the boundaries that I'm in? And also, when is it right for me to have conversations with my boss about things that I know that they are playing a role in, whether it's positively or negatively? And one of the things that I found that our younger cohorts aren't great at, that we need to develop some of these essential skills for them, is that they don't really know how to manage up. They often will go to their boss and say, I have this problem. Or we see this with the burnout. I'm burned out. Instead of going, okay, how am I burned out? What are the things that I'm dealing with that is stressing me out? And doing an audit of your workload. What's happening over the course of this 2 weeks? Spend 2 weeks journaling. Okay, I've got this area that maybe I've had to take on because someone's left. I'm not really skilled at this, but I'm doing it anyways because we're under-resourced. Maybe I've taken on a project that I thought I could have extra time for and I said yes to, and maybe I don't really actually have the time for it because all my other work is getting pushed down. Maybe I need some more technical development in certain areas that I thought I was really well-versed in, and I've pretended to everyone that I've got this really strong technical skill, but I actually need a little bit more training in it. These are all inefficiencies in our own work, in our workload, that adds to our working in our pajamas at 11 o'clock at night. Spending 2 weeks and really analyzing what is stressing me out, what's burning me out, what are some of the processes I could fix, and going to your manager and saying, so I audited my workload. These are the areas where I think I could use more help, or I could use more training, and have that conversation where you're presenting an idea to your boss so that they can help co-create solutions instead of it, I need you as my boss to solve it for me. And I think that I think certain generations just learn that because they would maybe be met with, you're fired or get out of my office if you came to them like that. So you had to figure it out and come up with these ideas to help yourself. But now there is an expectation for bosses and employees to work together. And so you have a choice of how you're going to manage up. And I do see that skill as something that we really need our younger generation to practice. We need leaders to develop that. We need to be able to make it so that there's more solutions-driven conversation instead of solve my problem for me. And that's just skill building that I think is missing right now.
Mm. And speaking of AI, I feel like that's somewhere that journaling with ChatGPT can really help you reflect.
It does solve so many problems like that. This is what's going on with my workload. Spend a bunch of time feeding ChatGPT with what's going on in your workload and ask for solutions. It's incredible how it can help you think through these kinds of issues. And of course, the nuances that there's not going to be any more resources potentially for another hire. It's understanding that like the scene within your team and within the organization, but it can really help you create a strategy. And it also makes you feel more in control. When you're feeling like everyone else is in control of your happiness and healthiness at work, you just feel very discouraged and hopeless. But if you can come up with some solutions, and sometimes you don't even need to go to your boss. Sometimes you can figure out, okay, actually, if I do this differently, that might save me an hour a week. And incrementally, those minutes and hours add up to get you back into a better manageable workload. And so I think this is just one example of what we could be doing better to have more control over our potential risk of stress and burnout. But I think that our younger cohorts need to develop those skills a little bit more. And again, they're just starting in their career. So this is where you're supposed to get that development, right? You don't just show up and have that. And I think this is a good opportunity for leaders and managers to just reinforce that kind of learning.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is shiny object syndrome. So coming at it from the perspective of the managers, you call that rushing into AI without fixing deeper workplace problems. And could you share an example where AI was overhyped versus when it actually improved work culture?
Oh my gosh, yes. You saw that a lot in journalism right away. This whole idea of just coming in and just replacing copy editors and journalists with AI, and some of the stuff that was coming out, especially, I mean, we're in a better iteration of AI now than we were even a couple of years ago, but just wholesale adopting AI and just focusing on that as being the core part of your business and then having such backlash. I cite an example of Gizmodo, which is basically hired all these or let go of their entire translation team, started using AI, and stuff was coming out like gobbledygook, and every one of their readers was just so angry about it, and it really turned people off. And so I think what that did was not good for AI's reputation either. It was like, see, AI just is ruining things instead of AI could be really helpful and if we use it the right way. Going in and making sure that you have a resource or a academic journal that's going to support your argument, like those types of things. And understanding too that this technology is still rife with errors. It provides sometimes it's called placeholder data, and it will just come up with the statistic like, oh, 70% of women feel like they don't want to go to work tomorrow. And you'll say, oh, can you fact check that? Well, actually, that was placeholder data. And a lot of people are still using it like it is the law. Mm-hmm. It has been fact checked. And so we have a long way to come before it really is that strong enough that you could use it to write something, because there's so many errors still with it. And I think that this idea of shiny object syndrome is that we just are putting way too much trust in something to take over like the core products that we are offering people. And instead it's about a slowing down, which again is so terrifying for people, this idea of slowing down. And I said something so provocative in this massive state of burnout that we're in. How about we don't grow this year? How about we just have a year where we're not growing? And that's impossible. But I've had some conversations now with CEOs that said, we've decided to look at this as a flat year so we can take a breath. And I've been really excited to see CEOs say that, because they know that it's not sustainable, because they've been in this mode for 5 years and they've said, we've decided to just look at this as a flat year. And they have to explain that to shareholders and stakeholders, and that can be scary. But it seems like more people are starting to understand that we need to just take some time to really do this so that people feel like that AI is there to support them, that it makes sense, that the senior leadership have understood the why, they know the assignment, and then we can all together cohesively move into the future kind of as a team with a shared vision. Because CEOs also know if you don't have people connected to a shared vision, then you're going to have a really hard time meeting those goals.
That reminds me, actually, as I was reading, I think it was chapter 4 on compassion, I wondered, what's the motivation for a CEO to adopt a compassionate mindset, to help people feel like it's not my job that's at risk, that AI actually, I think you put it in a wonderful way, it's AI and human that have to work together. But other than being an altruistic person, what would motivate someone to say, yes, this will be a flat year?
Yeah, I think this is progressive. And I do think that it feels like that doesn't make sense from a business outcome strategy. But I keep saying this isn't a benevolent strategy. It's a business strategy. It's not just because I'm nice that I'm doing this. These executives, and when I get them in the room and talk about it with them, because I've been pushing them for a long time to talk about maybe having a year that is not in growth mode, and they wouldn't hear it inside of 2023, I would say, and even early 2024. And what's interesting is in 2023, we had the highest CEO resignations and turnover of CEOs that we've seen in two decades. There was just massive shift, and CEOs were burned out themselves. And so when you, as a CEO at that level, burn out, you also recognize and have empathy for what that feels like to be running at that level and knowing that it isn't sustainable. And so what I've found is a lot of CEOs that have hit that wall have realized that this isn't going to be good for business if I'm losing talent, because it's the high performers and the talent that leave and you lose them to your competitors. It's not the people that are quiet quitting and rage applying. They're the ones just sitting there until they get a new job and not productive, not engaged. They're not leaving. They're going to leave when they find a new job or if it makes sense. But it's your high performers and that top talent that you're losing. And it is also when you want to have an organization that is hitting targets, they can't be exhausted. You cannot work if you're exhausted like that. And this is what we're seeing is a lot of this burnout conversation is hitting the bottom line in a big way. And when it becomes a bottom line issue, that's when you start to see CEOs making pivots around what their former strategy has been. When it stops working, then you realize, okay, this is a factor that I need to bring into my strategy. And it could be that we need to rest our workers a little bit.
I like that. It becomes a productivity and a bottom line problem. And you quote Bill Gates in part of the book, and I love his advice, which is, who is solving this problem well and what can we learn from them? So who is solving this problem well and what can we learn from them?
So I love that too, because it's a belonging strategy too. And it's an inclusive kind of question, because when you're just celebrating people for coming up with really great ideas to solve problems, we're not looking at demographic data. We're just looking at the ideas that people are coming up with. And so from celebrating people coming up with ways to make business better and to do things easier and more efficiently is a big part of what I think from an inclusion conversation is what we should be doing more. But from a who's solving this problem, I believe it's companies like Atlassian and organizations that are not burning people out to the point that they are throwing all of these policies at them to try to fix it, but it's actually increasing the stress and it's making people within the organization less likely to stay. It's creating all of this turmoil. And so what I love about Atlassian is they're a fully distributed workforce. They have a lot of trust in the people that they hire. They really believe in still having connectivity. So Annie Dean, I interviewed her, and she's in the book, and she's the lead of Team Anywhere at Atlassian. And what I love about her is she just really said, work is broken. We need to rethink it. And that means, yeah, we have to see each other and still be friends and hang out. But let's create these satellite offices where people can go around to, and we'll pay for them to come into and travel. You know, 50% of the New York office is always filled with people not from New York. So people were really encouraged to travel to different places. And they have 91% occupancy in these buildings at any one time, but they're fully distributed. So there's just a sense of that feeling that you have when culture's great. It's in the walls, it's in the spaces. And they've been able to capture that. And they've measured when they have, with what they do is bring their executives around to these different satellite offices. So you also could be like very junior product developer and be meeting with the CEO or senior executive. So it's making it so that there's accessibility to these people that honestly, in most cases, it's like a monolith and they live in the big tower and New York City, and you never get to ever meet them here. It's they're coming to you. And they found that these Team Anywhere, when they have these kind of 3 or 4 day connection events, that they find that employees actually increase by 3 times their number of ad hoc lunches that they have afterwards. So it like creates this sort of multiplex relationships, which is not just transactional. It's like these building of bridges. And you also aren't siloed then to your team, because if you're going to these different satellite offices, you're meeting all these different people across the organization. So it's not, so you feel a shared vision. And then they have these great hackathons every quarter where people get together and they just solve big problems using their skills. And a lot of the products have come out of these hackathons and anyone can participate. And it was really true to their culture. They have this tagline, it's all about getting shit done. And so they say that's what it is. It's still, we're working on things. We're still moving the needle, but we're doing it in a way that feels much more community driven. And they've had, in the last 3 or 4 years, they've had the best years of growth and sustainable growth. They're incredibly profitable. They've hired lots of great new people. They've expanded their product offerings and their human resources. So it's just, I think, they're an example of how we could be doing things really smartly and scalable. They've continued to scale. This is a very scalable thing. And I think that they're a good example of doing it right, but also getting shit done.
Yeah, I like how you referenced that earlier too, that a work ethic is not the opposite of finding purpose at work. Mm-hmm. So I would love to ask you more questions, but we're at time, unfortunately. There's so much more to be said. So I'll just say, please, everybody listening, read her book. It's good stuff. So thank you very much,
thank
Jennifer.
Thank you so much, Daniel. This was such a great conversation.
I started this podcast because I wanted to stand at the gate of businesses using AI and see what separated hype from lasting impact. Back when cities had walls, you had to go into the city to do business at the market. So if you wanted to talk to someone, you waited by the gate until they came in or came out. Do that enough times and you could talk to everyone. That's what I want to do. Stand at the gate of people doing business with AI and talk to them, see what they do and why they do it. If you know someone that's making an impact in the world of AI, would you connect them with me? You can find me on LinkedIn or shoot me an email at daniel@maneri.house. That's daniel@maneri.house. Thanks for listening.